Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For a nonfiction writer, it's very rare to see a book blurb from the subject of a biography. It's just not done. It's rarer still when the subject writes something like this. Quote, "Mark, you are a total loser, and your book and writings sucks," unquote. But when the subject is Donald Trump, well, then for New Yorker staff writer Mark Singer, those words become like a badge of honor. Singer famously profiled the presumptive Republican presidential nominee way back in 1997 in the magazine, and it must have stung because that quote earlier came up 8 years later. Now, Singer has put together a book featuring the infamous essay along with more thoughts about Donald Trump's seemingly improbable journey to the Republican nomination in his new book, Trump and Me. He'll be talking about Trump and the book tonight in a Book Smart Tulsa event at Congregation B'nai Emunah at 7 o'clock. Mark Singer has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1974. His books have included an account of the Penn Square bank collapse titled Funny Money, and Citizen K, the deeply weird American journal of Brett Kimberlin, along with two collections of his writings for The New Yorker. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Mark Singer, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's been a number of years, but welcome back.
Thank you, Rich. Happy to be here.
Your association, quote, association, unquote, with Donald Trump began back in 1996 when then New Yorker editor Tina Brown tasked you to do a profile on Donald Trump. What was your first reaction to that? Because it has lasted now a good 20 years almost.
Well, my first reaction was, please God, no. I wasn't in a strong position. I had been away writing a book that took me about 3 years longer than it was supposed to. So I'd been writing pieces for The New Yorker on and off, but not as many as Tina Brown, the editor, wanted. So I say this in my book, I said Tina and I had a very clear understanding, and our understanding was that in her desk there was a special drawer, and in that drawer was a jar, and in that jar were my testicles. So I was off and running that way. She told Trump that he would love to be written about by me, that he was going to love the result or something. She said, you're going to love him or love me. And it didn't really work out that way. But I spent a lot of time with him over a period of several months before I finally was really ready to write. And I don't know what that accumulated amount of time was, but it was enough that I was a fly on the wall in many situations. I traveled with him. I was present when welcome. I never try to barge in places. I never do that, and I don't go where I'm not wanted as a reporter. So I've always said, when you want me to leave the room, kick me out. The nice thing with Trump, if you're a reporter, is that he's not interested in anyone but himself. So I really could be a fly on the wall, and it was just, I didn't have to ask a lot of questions most of the time.
You've described him as the least self-aware person you've ever met.
He is, in my experience, yes, the least self-aware person I've ever met. I've known a couple other people who were pretty high up there, but he's even said to one of his biographers, I don't like to analyze myself because I might not like what I see. And I think that says, that kind of strikes me as both extremely self-aware and utter lacking in self-awareness. But this notion that you don't want to look inside yourself because you might not like what I see. I mean, I'd never heard anyone say that.
Now, if I remember right, this was the first sort of celebrity profile you'd done at The New Yorker.
Well, there have been others. I don't like writing about celebrities as a rule. I prefer, I don't know how to say it without sounding patronizing, but pretty much regular people. I've written about distinguished people in various fields, but certainly it's much easier to write about someone who hasn't been written about a great deal. With someone like Donald Trump, he's been written about so much that the difficulty is even coming up with questions that he hasn't been asked. And in my mind, there's no point in asking questions anytime if you can find the answer somewhere else. So a lot of it is sitting back and observing and just listening, because he will talk.
But also at the same time, you said this lack of self-awareness. Did you always feel like there was a guard up, or was it just sort of he let fly what he would let fly as it comes into his mind?
This gets at a tricky part of understanding Donald Trump, I think. He chose at some point in his 20s when he was starting out in the real estate business, this was his father's business that he was expanding from the outer boroughs, from Queens and Brooklyn, mostly Queens, into Manhattan. And he needed his father's credit to do anything. His father was co-signing all of his loans. But he had a project, which was to really brand himself, which meant sacrificing Donald Trump the person for Donald Trump the persona. He is all persona. So that's a sort of shell, a carapace that he lives within. I don't know that the guard is up so much. He also has, you know, the strangest combination of insecurity and certitude. No one talks about himself that much. No one uses different synonyms for large, big, huge. Certainly no one goes on the stage at a presidential debate to try to reassure people about his sexual adequacy, who's not tremendously insecure. So there's that. But within that, he still is able to project force and power, and he has money. He has a lot less money than he says he does. I don't have the exact answer to that because it's a privately held company, the Trump Organization. The only time people really had insight into that was when his casinos were up and running and they were publicly traded. But anyway, he just is himself. I think he's so entitled that he just does what he wants. And he doesn't obviously at this point think that there's such a thing as bad publicity. So it's not necessarily that guarded.
Well, and you know, you've met, I'm sure, a lot of people who have personas. There's a public persona and then there's their private self. What I read from the original piece was there was no scratching the surface and finding the private person. It's a persona in public and private.
It is. I once asked him, I don't remember the moment, we were down in Florida at Mar-a-Lago, his palatial resort club, whatever you want to call it. And we did. There were times we spent together one-on-one, but again, he never asked me a question about myself. He had zero curiosity in me, which is perfectly fine. I like that. But at some point, I did find an opening to ask him sort of who he, you know, relies upon, who he turned to in sort of moments of personal tribulation. And he said, nobody. It's just not my thing. I took that at face value. I'm sure there are other people that way, but he most certainly is.
Now, we think of Trump, the presidential candidate. What does that say to him, that he doesn't rely on anybody at a time of crisis?
He doesn't rely on anyone in times of crisis. And until very recently, he has kept his own counsel. He's been asked, you know, who's his, advisor on defense. And he said, well, you know, I listen to myself. I'm very smart. I have a very good brain. Well, he's missing something if he thinks that that's the way to be the leader of the free world. So really, my theory, Rich, is that Donald Trump doesn't want to be president. He knows that subconsciously if he doesn't know it consciously, because let's just say his subconscious has been informed that he doesn't want to be president. And the evidence of it is all the self-subverting things he has done, a total lack of preparation. I mean, he was able to get through the Republican debates by sheer force of personality. He is a celebrity. I never watched The Apprentice, but I know that is really the source of his popularity. He's very entertaining. Whether you're watching him on Fox News or MSNBC, he's entertaining. But, you know, I suppose in the same sense that a roadside accident is entertaining. If people look, even when they shouldn't, when they're going by at 70 miles an hour. But he's trusted himself for too long. But I don't think that he would have, picked a racially charged fight with a federal judge involved in a lawsuit that's only about his personal business if he wanted to be elected. There was a woman named Stephanie Segielski who this past March wrote a piece online for a publication online and described how a year earlier, in March of 2015, remember he announced his candidacy in June of 2015, that big ride down the escalator at the Trump Tower and all the welcoming words for Mexicans and Muslims. But she was told when she joined as the communications director for the Make America Great Again Super PAC that he wanted to finish second, poll about 12 or 15% of the vote, but finish second in the delegate count, and that this was, quote-unquote, a protest candidacy. I have no reason, based on the evidence, to doubt that story.
One of the things I was looking at is all the things that presidential candidates usually try to avoid. You mentioned his announcement speech where he basically called Mexican illegal immigrants rapists and drug dealers. He insulted war veterans. He insulted John McCain within weeks.
Did you think that John McCain was the end of Trump when he said that?
I don't know. But I'm just saying if you take all these things in totality, he's feuded with Fox News and a Fox News host. He's attacked the Pope. He is... used imagery from anti-Semitic websites and put them out as his own attack ad on Hillary Clinton. He's, congratulates Scotland after the Brexit vote the day after Scotland overwhelmingly voted to stay in the EU. I mean, do you suppose it's really this that he doesn't want to be president?
Yes, I do suppose that. But he also didn't expect that he was going to soar to the head of the pack. And once that happened, then his ego certainly kicked in. I mean, this is a person who is most happy, obviously, when he can ride in his limo and see his name plastered all over buildings, when he can hear his name, especially when he could appear before a rally, a political rally, and just hear the crowd, you know, roaring with appreciation. And I don't think that his talent for demagoguery necessarily surprised him, but I think the result did, because then it became this, you know, beast that needed to be fed, and he did. He fed it, you know, as many fighting words as he could come up with, basically, no matter who he hurt in the process. I still am not over the scene of him ridiculing a New York Times reporter who was physically disabled, mocking a disabled person. When you do that, that tells me he doesn't want to be president, but he's gotten away with it. So I think his great fear, it's been his fear his entire life, is being called a loser. That's his favorite epithet.
And so once he went up to the top of the polls, that sort of win or die instinct sort of has kicked in.
I think he's in a really awkward spot. I really do. I think he, you know, it seems an odd way to characterize it, but I think he's outsmarted himself. I don't think he's very smart. I think he has instincts that are very sharp, but I mean book smart. This is a person who really barely reads. And as you mentioned, the Brexit vote, he was asked the day before the vote by Fox Business what his position on it was. And he said, well, I don't think you should listen to me because I haven't really studied it that much. This is, to me, I don't know, maybe I'm a very delicate person who's easily shocked, but I still find that astonishing. And then, of course, 2 days later, when he did fly into Scotland, the day after the Leave faction prevailed, but that was despite the fact that Scotland was something like 65% to 70% for Remain, and then he just spouts off, "Hey, it's going wild here. This is great. They're taking their country back."
Prescient for the upcoming vote on Scottish independence that's likely to come out of Brexit.
Right, exactly.
Well, my guest today is Mark Singer, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Trump and Me. He'll be appearing tonight at a BookSmart Tulsa event at 7 o'clock at a Congregation B'nai Emunah. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So with all this, you said he wanted to do it as a protest stunt. But is it that simple? Why would he run for president?
Well, he toyed with running for president in the past often. And I think, there's a theory that when President Obama ridiculed him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011.
This is about his belief in birther.
This was after Trump had been going around saying that, of course, the president was not born in this country and making up amazing stories. Like, I sent all these investigators out to Hawaii, and you could not believe the amazing things they're turning up. And obviously he sent no investigators to Hawaii. This is, you know, his compulsive lying, his for whatever reason he was threatened by Barack Obama. I think there was a racial element to it, obviously. I didn't see that in the late 90s when I was with him. I spent a lot of time with him. I never saw any indication that he was a racist. But something changed. That is the main thing that changed, and it sort of opened some kind of floodgate for him where he could sort of freely let the bigotry flow.
Now, we should mention this profile took place in about 1996 and 97.
Yes.
And at that time, you sort of admitted you kind of liked the guy. I mean, it was obviously the ego was there this lack of self-awareness, but it's at some level he was a likable guy.
You know, it's so funny. I've been talking about this book, so you're hardly the first person to tell me that I kind of like the guy.
But you didn't.
And I must have said it in the piece. I can't remember that. I think I found him entertaining, and you know, we spent time one-on-one. So again, it was me either just listening or asking the occasional question and observing. But after a while, it got to be too much. I mean, this piece ended with me. You know, Trump talked about the real estate he sold as belonging to three categories: luxury, super luxury, and super, super luxury. And so I end the piece by saying that he had aspired to and achieved the ultimate luxury, an existence unmolested by the rumbling of a soul. Now, he didn't care for that, and I don't think that it's an indication that I was really overly fond of him, but you're right. I think there were times when he was affable and kind of amusing, but for the most part, he doesn't have a sense of irony.
Yeah, and of course, he took exception to that piece when it came out 1997, and fast forward 8-9 years later, you're still a bug in his craw. He does not like. You have republished the piece in a collection called Character Studies, and a reviewer mentions the Trump piece, and immediately he fires back a letter to the New York Times Book Review.
Well, what happened was that he originally, when this first profile first appeared in 1997, he published a book later that year called Trump, The Art of the Comeback. He had been on his heels. He'd stiffed his banks for $800 million. He was too big to fail during the real estate crash, basically, in Atlantic City. He totally busted there. So he published this book, and in it, one of the things he was coming back at. So he described the genesis of this piece for The New Yorker, and he has a description of me that thrilled me. He said, you know, when Mark Singer came into my office, I immediately sensed that he was not much of anything. you know, then he insulted my physical appearance and everything, and it was great. I mean, I read that and I thought, well, I can die happy. You know, I was excited when my children were born, but this is coming in close in a second. So then that's the end of that. I don't respond to that. But then I did put this profile in a collection, as you mentioned, Character Studies, and it was reviewed in the New York Times. This is 2005. And the New York Times review was favorable review, although the reviewer had one exception to one piece, and he said it was a Trump profile, which, because Trump was a caricature of a caricature, he was too easy a target.
He was shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, he said Trump lacks the wit and the foot speed to defend himself. And we'll think again, because Trump writes a letter to the New York Times Book Review that appeared 3 weeks later that was attacking me and this reviewer. And it was, let's just say, written without advice of counsel. it was a wonderful assault. And he talked about what a great writer he was. He had all these ghostwritten books, but he was a great writer. And I was a no talent, whatever. And so that I knew that letter was coming. I'd seen the New York Times Book Review a few days ahead of time. So I checked my Amazon numbers for the sales of this book, and it was terrible. You know, it's like 50,000 something on the bestseller list. And then Trump publishes this letter, and within 48 hours, my number's up. I'm up to 385 on Amazon, and I have people calling me and telling me, you know, how can I get Trump to attack me? So I wrote him a letter, which in which I sort of stuck the shiv in a bit further, and I sent him a check. I was going to send him $1,000, and I thought that's excessive. I wanted to send him something he liked. You know, money. I know he likes money. So anyway, I sent him a check for $37.82, which I said was a small token of my gratitude.
It's like a tipping a quarter.
Yeah, I was like tipping a quarter, exactly. $37.82. And I said, I also enclosed two Band-Aids because you seem unable to stop picking at this particular scab. These should come in handy. And so I figured that's not going to be the end of it. And indeed, a week later or so, I get this letter back in the mail. My letter to him, Trump Organization envelope. And he just writes on it, Mark, you are a total loser, and your book and writings sucks, which is
and
framed.
You put parentheses around, and your writings.
And your writings sucks. And so that actually is the blurb on the back jacket. That's the only blurb I have on this
book. So you
book.
Really paid him for the blurb close to 10 years before you actually wrote this book.
And the $37.82 check he cashed. I got that in my bank statement. My assumption is he needed the money. And so it's been, that's been a very valuable insult.
If we can be serious for just a moment, just that this whole thing, you know, this is a profile at that point 8 years ago.
Yes.
He remembers it. He responds to it. That temperament, that's kind of scary to think of that in the president of the United States.
We've seen it on the campaign trail. This is a very thin-skinned person. Not the person you would be at the top of your list of someone you wanted, you know, holding the nuclear codes. And I don't think I can begin to imagine what other people find reassuring in that particular trait of his. I don't. Maybe people don't want to. Look, people see what they want to see, believe what they want to believe. There are all kinds of reasons to explain the Trump phenomenon. And there are very powerful, legitimate grievances that many, many voters in this country have. Doesn't make them racist that they're for Donald Trump. They feel that they're losing something. Very much, I think it has a lot to do with promises that have been made by both political parties, the Republican Party as much as the Democratic Party, that have not delivered for working class people. There has been, as we all know, a really ever-widening divide between, you know, the very rich and the rest of the country, the 1% and everybody else. And that is at the root of the anger that Trump is leveraging, you know, quite effectively. But I think that these self-subverting things he's done make him not electable. And, you know, call me on November 9th and tell me I'm wrong. I could be.
You know, we referenced Brexit earlier. Brexit, both heads of the major parties in the UK were against voting for the Brexit. Another major party in the north, in Scotland, which controls practically all the seats in Scotland, were against it. And yet, outside of London and a few big cities in the UK and the north, Scotland and Northern Ireland to a lesser extent, the rest of the country voted for Brexit despite both parties. And it's a lot of people say it's that same sort of alienation.
It's the same forces. It's globalization. You're not really in control of anything. When Donald Trump goes to West Virginia and promises coal miners that their jobs are coming back, that's cruelty. You know, they want to believe something. We're not using coal in this country. It's not the most efficient fuel. It's certainly not the safest fuel. Environmentally and otherwise, those jobs are not going to come back. That's a worldwide phenomenon. All kinds of things are being dislocated. They're not local circumstances. They're global circumstances that are seriously directly affecting people's lives. And then on top of it, because through the EU, you obviously had free, no borders. Immigration, and that has become a huge crisis because there's a humanitarian crisis in the Middle East, and those people are fleeing for their lives and very often losing their lives in the process of fleeing, and they have to go somewhere. This country isn't taking them, and I understand the sentiment in Europe. We have to find some humanity, but it's not coming from Donald Trump.
And there's plenty of politicians on both sides of the pond that will take those immigrants as a symbol for why the middle class is not progressing or the working class is not progressing.
Well, it's a scapegoat. Always good to have a scapegoat, and you can always find one when you need one.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, you've been writing about Trump in the book Trump and Me, and recalling the profile you did and some new writing as a part of Trump and Me. So what do you think is going to happen next week at the Republican National Convention and into the fall? You think he's...
I'm going to be watching along with you. I don't know. I don't think that he's not going to be the nominee, but I don't rule that out. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm obviously watching this guy and watching people scrambling to outmaneuver him. And there's all these things about convention rules and whatnot, and I'm not versed in that at all. So I don't know. Maybe that's entertaining, you know, that's suspenseful. That's going to be kind of, I mean, I think probably the debates with Hillary Clinton are going to come closer to challenging the Super Bowl, but we'll see. I think the convention is going to be potentially very dramatic.
You know, a lot of times in his public pronouncements, he's never provided very many details at all. Tax returns is another issue. You know, and I think the prognosticators are saying, well, is it because he's not worth as much, or will we find that he hasn't paid any tax? Do you think the public is going to demand to the point that he actually puts forward specific positions and releases things like tax returns and all these sort of things that we expect from a presidential candidate?
This is what I mean about Art smarting himself. He's in a no-win position there. He has to release his tax returns, or if he doesn't, it's going to be, you know, an issue in the general election. He hasn't done it yet, but he's going to come up against it. And I think the answer is, A, he doesn't pay much in tax, and he isn't worth very much.
Well, we'll have to wait and see if that actually comes out or not. And
more damningly, I think the fact that he evidently gives so little to charity is also something that does not want disclosed.
Yeah. The name of the book is Trump and Me. Mark Singer, pleasure to have you back. Thanks very much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure each time I come here. Thank you so much.
Mark Singer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Trump and Me. He'll be speaking tonight in a BookSmart Tulsa event at Congregation B'nai Emunah at 7 o'clock. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.